From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On Story features discussions with a diverse array of voices who use the language of film and television to tell a story. This week, screenwriter Dale Lawner discusses writing and producing his acclaimed film, My Cousin Vinny, on its 25th anniversary.
You in law school, okay, we're engaged, but you have to get through law school, and you have to pass the bar, and you have to win your first case, and then I'll marry you. So that apparently takes 10 years, right?
And actress Parker Posey looks back on her experience working with Christopher Guest on his cult classic, Waiting for Guffman.
Libby May. It's a chicken wing, a single chicken wing and a barbecue.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We'll be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Dale Lawner is the screenwriter of Ruthless People and the remake of the 1965 film Bedtime Story, which he optioned, rewrote, and executive produced as Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. After that, he directed and produced Love Potion No. 9, and then wrote and produced My Cousin Vinny, which was released in 1992. In 2016, Lawner was honored to have two movies placed on the Writers Guild of America's 101 Funniest Movies of All Time. Dale Lawner spoke with me at the Paramount Theater in June of 2017 at a 25th anniversary screening of My Cousin Vinny. Clips in this episode copyright 20th Century Fox Film Corporation. We open this segment with a clip from My Cousin Vinny.
Vin, you graduated from law school 6 years ago. What have you been doing since?
Studying for the bar.
6 years?
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of studying.
Well, you know, to be honest with you, I didn't pass my first time out.
That's okay. You probably passed the second time, right?
I'm afraid not.
Three times a charm?
Not for me, it isn't. Nope. For me, six times was a charm.
So this is a little bit of a different courtroom procedural kind of film, right, that you did. And you talked a little bit in the beginning about how the idea came to you. And did you actually tell me you were 19 when this idea came to you?
Yes, I was 19 years old.
Okay. Had you ever been pulled over in Alabama?
I had not been in Alabama yet. I had a vague idea for the movie, so I had the studio pay for me to do a sort of a research trip. So I flew down to New Orleans, picked up a Ford Probe, drove up through Mississippi, and there was a point where I was on the road where they had repaved the road, and the road suddenly was about this much higher. And I was going, oh, maybe 70, maybe 80 miles an hour. And when you hit something like that, the car went out of control. And it was one of those divided highways. In the middle of it, there was this depressed area and a lot of water. And the car headed out towards the water. And I thought, am I going into a lake? And in fact, it was not that deep. And there was a lot of mud. And I was introduced to Mississippi mud. And I was stuck. I wasn't stuck there but a minute when a pickup truck was going by, saw me, stopped, pulls out, tells me it's going to be $100. And I said, okay. And he pulled me out. And then as I was driving into town, there was a wheel that was kind of going boom, 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 boom. And there was a guy who, I didn't know what was wrong. I thought there was either a flat tire or he'd bent a rim or something. And the guy says, no, you got mud in your tire.
I don't see anything out of whack under there.
It feels like the wheels went out of balance right after we hit that mud.
Nah, that's not it.
I think you should put it on a rack and take a look.
What's wrong?
What?
What's the problem?
Nothing. The car was shimmying on the highway a little bit.
Yeah, you got mud in your tires.
I got mud in my tires?
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you a question. How do you get mud into the tires?
Oh, no. You see, that's just a figure of speech. See, the mud gets around the inside of the wheel, throws the balance off.
You ever hear that? Mud in the tires?
No.
She never heard it. She knows everything about cars.
Now, see, down here, everybody gets stuck in the mud every now and then. Yep. Yeah, we're famous for our mud.
And that's so all that stuff and research, because you don't have the story down yet. But, you know, you write down these notes and, you know, try to work them in. I remember going to a restaurant once, and it just said, breakfast, lunch, dinner. There was no other menu, right? I wrote that down. So that's in the movie. It was the late 90s, and people were very afraid of AIDS. And so I remember going to the doctor, and I got a number of blood tests, including an AIDS test. And I remember in the editing room calling the doctor for the blood results. And I hear his assistant ruffle through some papers, and then she stops, apparently frozen, and says, you're going to have to talk to the doctor. So for I'm not sure how long it was, my life was passing in front of me. I thought, what am I going to do? I'm going to die. And the doctor got on the phone and said, you have high cholesterol. So the cholesterol thing came into play, Southern fried cooking. And so, you know, that thing where he takes some lard and puts it on the griddle. And he says, are you familiar with the ongoing cholesterol problem in this country? That's where that joke came from, right? So there was a grit section, and I thought, wow, okay. And then, so I was looking over the grits. So I'd never had grits before. A grit.
What's this over here?
You never heard of grits?
Sure, I heard of grits. I just actually never seen a grit before. Yeah, honey, you can try it.
You first.
What is a grit, anyways?
It's made out of corn. Them hominy grits.
Hominy.
So it was fun working all that stuff into the story.
You went to film school, so you could get away with watching a bunch of movies, but somehow you managed to do a movie that they're teaching in law school. So what kind of research did you do that way?
I had a friend of mine, old friend from high school named Doug Knoll, and Doug had gone to law school. So we would meet for lunch or breakfast or brunch, and I would ask him questions. And there was so much I didn't understand, and I wanted to make it more clear in this movie. So I had seen other courtroom movies. You know, my father was an actor, and he was in 33. He played the judge in 33 episodes of Perry Mason. But you would watch these courtroom dramas on TV or in movies, and someone say leading the witness, I didn't know what that meant. Although I don't think I explained it in here, but there was so much stuff in there, and they say, like, how do you plea?
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're speaking with screenwriter Dale Lawner on the 25th anniversary of My Cousin Vinny. The film, directed by British director Jonathan Lynn, boasts an eclectic cast, which includes Joe Pesci, Marissa Tomei, Ralph Macchio, Lane Smith, Austin Pendleton, and Bruce McGill. The late Fred Gwynne played the role of Judge Chamberlain Haller. It was his last role before his death in 1993. Best known for his role as Herman Munster in the hit television show from the 1960s, Gwynne graduated from Harvard University and was actually the president of the Harvard Lampoon during his senior year. When we left off, Dale Lawner was discussing the challenges of portraying courtroom procedure in the script for My Cousin Vinny. Here's a courtroom clip featuring Fred Gwynne and Joe Pesci.
How do your clients plead?
My clients are caught completely by surprise. They thought they were getting arrested for shoplifting a can of tuna.
What are you telling me? That they plead not guilty?
No, I'm just trying to explain.
I don't want to hear explanations. The state of Alabama has its procedure. And that procedure at this point in time is to have an arraignment. Are we clear on this?
Yes. But there seems to be a great deal of confusion here.
Mr. Gambini.
See, my clients are...
Mr. Gambini.
And I think, do they want to know guilty or not guilty, you know? Because if they say he's a guilty or not guilty, I understand the question. But I didn't understand some of the stuff, right? So I wanted to explain it. So I was asking him about procedure, and when I asked him, do you learn this in college? And he says, in law school, he says, no. No. Yeah. Well, where do you learn it? He says, you either go to court and you watch and you learn yourself, or the law firm that hires you will teach you. And I thought, whoa, there's the movie right there. Because Vinny's never been, he's never been hired by a law firm. He's really only been in court once to fight a ticket. So he's not going to know this. Then I also decided, let's make it even worse and better, is I made Vinny dyslexic. So when Vinny explains that it took him 6 times to pass the bar, and I think one of the kids says, well, that's a lot. And Vinny explains, he says, I'm a little dyslexic. And then in the next scene, he's handed this book. Well, that's kind of funny, and it's also somewhat endearing and sympathy-inducing, because you're on his side, and it's not going to be easy for him to get through this. But it explains why he's such a disaster in terms of criminal court procedure. So I kept all that going in the story. So I wanted us to learn it as he learns it. So there's a scene in there where he thinks he's sweet-talking Trotter into giving him all the records. And she's the one that's been reading the book.
Wonder why Trotter gave you his files?
I told you why already.
He has to. By law, you're entitled. It's called disclosure, you d***head. He has to show you everything, otherwise it could be a mistrial. He has to give you a list of all his witnesses. You can talk to all his witnesses. He's not allowed any surprises.
Right? Now, I didn't know that, and nor is it ever explained in any courtroom movie what disclosure is. And in fact, every court case you see, you know what's going on. And to make it interesting for a movie, you have to introduce a witness later on, or you have to introduce some evidence that has to be a surprise. And you realize that's in every courtroom drama, right? There has to be some sort of a twist. But because if you knew what the disclosure was, which nobody shows in any movie, there's no reason to watch what goes on in the courtroom. You've already gone over all that. You've taken a deposition. You know what they're going to say. So there has to be some kind of surprise in there. So that's what was interesting about the movie, is that I followed everything, you know, realistically.
Did you spend a lot of time actually in the courtroom watching cases?
No, but I read about it. There are books on humor and funny things that actually happen in courtrooms. And since they really existed, I could just lift them right out of that book and put it in the movie. So there was only a couple things we used. One, where there was a woman that was being, I think, a voir dire for the jury. And she says she doesn't believe in capital punishment. And they described exactly what the murder was, and it involved torture. It was horrible. And she said, fry him, right? So we put that in the script. I put that in there. That's fine. It happened. The other, where someone was talking about I'm not sure what the device was that actually will break down material. You can look at the rubber and see what it's made out of, whatever. And and he described it with dual flame analyzers. And Vinny says, someone says, does that come turbocharged? And he said, only in the floor models. So that actually happened. So that goes in the script.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We'll be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back celebrating the 25th anniversary of My Cousin Vinny with screenwriter Dale Lawner, speaking at a special event held at the Paramount Theater in Austin, Texas in June 2017.
So were you ever a mechanic?
Yeah, no, that stuff I got off the top of my head, believe it or not. I didn't do any research on it. And it's the result of what was, up till that point, misspent youth. When I was 16 or 17, I could tell you the horsepower, weight, engine displacement, engine layout, suspension layout of every single car sold in America. So, and other stuff. So all the stuff with the 327 Chevy, the 4, all, That came off the top of my head. I don't remember it now, but I remember writing it in.
Now, in the 60s, there were only two other cars made in America that had positive traction and independent rear suspension and enough power to make these marks. One was the Corvette, which could never be confused with the Buick Skylark. The other had the same body length, height, width, weight, wheel base, and wheel track as the 64 Skylark, and that was the 1963 Pontiac Tempest.
And because both cars were made by GM, were both cars available in metallic mint green paint?
They were.
The studio does something called a DeForest Report, which they sent it out to get it verified. And so it all came back verified. There was one thing they cut out because there was one other car that had independent suspension that was sold in America in 1964, and that was the Chevy Corvair. And so that was taken out of the script. I didn't take it out, and I thought, nobody's going to know that. And the only person I know who would know that would be Steve Lee. When Steve Lee was a friend in high school, and he was as much a car nut as I was, and he was sort of an auto shop buddy. And I said, no one's going to know this. And then at the premiere, Steve Lee shows up. And he not only shows up, after the screen, he says, you know, there were three cars with independent...
So I want to talk a little bit about casting and about, you know, the process of how you chose the cast you chose.
I remember taking a casting meeting with the studio CEO and the president. And they asked me, who do you want to play Vinny? So I said, Robert De Niro. And the president says, he does this. You know, De Niro, he's just not funny, and his movies don't make money. Well, this was 1991. He'd only been in one comedy, which was Midnight Run, which was he was not only good in, it was successful. But oddly enough, De Niro was likened to Jack Lemmon, which seems kind of weird, but I think it was probably the idea he can do comedy and he can be straight, too. And so De Niro was out 20 or some odd years, 25 years later, and the only movies we know De Niro makes money in are comedies. When I first wrote the first draft of the script and I handed it in, and you have what they call a creative meeting, and the president of the studio says, this is, I remember the words verbatim, good work, very funny, good job. Do you think you could cut the character of Lisa out of the movie? Really? Yeah. I said, that's like saying, I like that movie, Easy Rider, can you cut the lawyer out? Why he wanted to cut that out made no sense to me. He said, because it's so good, I want to give some of those lines to Vinny. I said, I think this works better. It works better as a couple. So the next draft, I not only did not cut her out, I ingrained her deeper into the script. So there was no way you could take her out. So... when I did research for the movie and I was driving through Alabama, like I said, I stopped off in Butler, Alabama, I went and knocked on the door of a district attorney or an assistant district attorney. And he looked like Lane Smith, an actor that I knew, and Lane played Trotter. I don't know if that guy's name was Trotter or I don't know where I came up with Trotter, but he looked like Lane Smith. And so when I wrote the character, I thought of Lane in mind, and so that's how Lane got into the movie. So,
well, how did you get Pesci? How did you end up with him?
They went out to Danny DeVito. Danny was interested. I had a meeting with Danny, and I said, so are you interested in acting in this or directing it or both? He goes, I don't know. Well, okay. But he wanted some changes to the script. He was never happy with it, so he dropped out. Andrew Dice Clay was, you know, sort of at the peak of his career. So we were talking about Andrew Dice Clay. What happened is there was a studio executive there on the movie, and she was dating Andrew Dice Clay's manager. And she met Andrew, who said something so horribly insulting to her. She called me up. She was so upset. And I said, okay, we're not going to put him in the movie. And that was it. Joe Pesci came up. And Joe had been in a few successful movies, comedies, the Home Alone movies, Lethal Weapon. And so we hired him. And my reluctance was I needed a guy who had a little bit of a bad to him. And Joe Pesci didn't strike me as a bad. Well, I had not seen Goodfellas. It had not been released yet. And so Goodfellas came out. And it was like, and he's definitely a bad than that. And then he got an Oscar for it. So, while we were shooting the movie, actually. So that's how Joe got it. Marissa was on. I gave a list to the casting director, David Rubin, of I thought maybe 10 actresses. I don't think there was that many. It was probably like maybe 6 or 7. And Marissa was on it. I think she was the last on the list, not so much because of acting chops, because she was 23 years old, or she was very young compared to Joe. It was just such a disparity there. But she was very good. I had seen her in a play in New York called, I think, Avenue Boys, and she was in this acting group called Naked Angels, and she was really good. So she was on the list. But the other women on the list, interestingly enough, inspired the character. One was Carol Davis, who was an actress and a hip-hop artist. I was friendly with her, and when I was driving through the Deep South and I was in Alabama, I gave her a call, and I was describing the little town with the little town square that the movie was based on, which was Butler, Alabama. And she says, and she talks like this a little bit, right? She's a New Yorker, right? She says, I bet the Chinese food is terrible, right? And I thought, that's a good line. All right, I'll put that one in, right? So she was on the list. There was another woman, Lisa Gay, who is an actress in the Toxic Avenger movies. And I remember meeting her. We once went out to play pool, and she had her own pool cue. And so that's how Lisa knows how to play pool. And the name Lisa got in there, too. And there was another woman named Nancy Boyka. She's since passed away. I've known Nancy since junior high school. And Nancy and a guy named Staples Burkhart lived together, and they had the most acrimonious arguments. I mean, they were vicious, ugly, horrible arguments. But they did them for fun. And they would perform when people would stop by. They'd get into arguments, right? And they'd go back and forth, and like one of them would say something particularly vicious and ugly, and the other would go, oh, that was good. That was good. All right, that was good, right? So they would sort of step out of it and remark about it. So I wanted the whole thing about them arguing, that came into play, and I thought it was also works well in the story that if they're both good at arguing, that it will be good as a litigator to understand arguments. So that's that whole scene with the drip and the plumbing and everything. So
maybe you didn't twist it hard enough.
I twisted it just right.
How could you be so sure?
If you will look in the manual, you will see that this particular model faucet requires a range of 10 to 16 foot-pounds of torque. I routinely twist maximum allowable torqueage.
Well, how could you be sure you used 16 foot-pounds of torque?
Because I used a Craftsman Model 1019 Laboratory Edition Signature Series torque wrench, the kind used by Caltech high-energy physicists and NASA engineers.
Well, I wouldn't have expected those two to have so much great chemistry, but they surely do. How did you all help them get that chemistry? Did you have to, or did they just sort of figure it out themselves?
No, I think chemistry is mostly made up. It's on the page.
Well,
if the actors are good, right, they'll pull it off, you know, because they're both, as actors, the character is after. It's very well defined and well delineated, and they know what they have to do. So it should be on the page.
Well, so I'm going to ask you then I'm going to open it up for questions, but my favorite scene in here and the inspiration for it, since so many of these seem to have your real life inspiration, is the scene where they're at the hunting cabin and she's walking up and down in that ridiculous outfit.
Because I know you got enough pressure on you already, but we agreed to get married as soon as you won your first case. Meanwhile, 10 years later, my niece, the daughter of my sister, is getting married. My biological clock is ticking like this, and the way this case is going, I ain't never getting married.
Now that came out of when the studio executive said, can you cut the character of Lisa out of the movie? And then later, he wanted some sort of conflict where she would, maybe she complains that she's not getting enough attention from him. And I thought, what a horribly misogynist idea. This needy woman who's complaining, you're not giving me enough attention. Meanwhile, he is having trouble with the judge. A dress code problem. He can't sleep. There's two kids that have been accused of murder in a state that routinely executes its capital offenders. And she's being needy. I'd hate her, right? So I wanted to come up with something. I came up with that, you know, and I think I said that in the meeting that he would yell at her, right? And, you know, what a horrible person. So I figured, now I got to make it work for her so I can use that, because I thought that was pretty good. But I wanted to make it where I still like her. And so I came up with this whole backstory. It's not quite in the movie, but it would be in the prequel, if that ever gets written or made, where they have a problem. And she actually breaks up with Vinny. Because he has no prospects and he's 30 years old and, you know, she had just turned 18 and she found out some stuff about him she didn't like and she basically broke off their engagement. So he's lost her, he's brokenhearted, and he goes to court to fight a ticket. And he fights the ticket so well that the judge, who was doing some paperwork, starts listening to him, becomes very entertained, becomes very amused, and actually applauds. Vinny not only wins the ticket, he proves that the policeman actually broke the law he accused Vinny of, right? And gets him to admit it, right? So it'd be a fun scene. This happened to me, okay? And so Vinny, he tells Vinny, you argued that point so well, you must be a law student. He says, no. Well, you should be a litigator. And Vinny says, I didn't know what that meant. Sounds like a little alligator. And the judge encouraged him to go to law school. So Vinny goes back to Lisa and says, I'm going to go to law school. And again, this is dialogue that's not in the movie, but she says, you're going to go to law school? You think we're going to get back together because you say you're going to go to law school? And she says, no. Yeah, no, I'm not going to marry you. Yeah, I got you. Tell you, you go to law school. You in law school, okay, we're engaged. But you have to get through law school. And you have to pass the bar. And you have to win your first case, and then I'll marry you. So that apparently takes 10 years, right? So that became the whole backstory for that scene. So that's they stuck that in there. And so she's been waiting for him to get through law school, to pass the bar, now to win the first case, and now she's looking at this, and so she's upset. And now what I had written in the scene is she's far more apologetic about being upset, and that Vinny has to pry it out of her. That was cut out of the script. I wish it wasn't.
Screenwriter Dale Lawner speaking at the Paramount Theater at the 25th anniversary screening of his classic comedy, My Cousin Vinny. You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Following her role in Richard Linklater's 1993 cult hit, Dazed and Confused, Parker Posey played a series of roles in independent films in the 1990s, such as Party Girl and The House of Yes, which gained her the nickname Queen of the Indies. She later played improvisational roles in Christopher Guest mockumentaries, including Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, A Mighty Wind, and For Your Consideration. Her other appearances include You've Got Mail, Superman Returns, and the Woody Allen films Irrational Man and Cafe Society. On television, Posey has guest starred in series such as Will and Grace, Boston Legal,
Louie, Parks and Recreation, and Search Party. I spoke with Parker Posey at a 2016 Austin Film Festival retrospective screening of Christopher Guest's Waiting for Guffman. Clips in this episode copyright Castle Rock Entertainment.
I've been working here at the DQ for about 8 months, seven. I don't know, something like that. It's fun. Just do the cones, make sundaes, make blizzards, and put stuff on them, and see a lot of people come in. A lot of people come to the DQ. Burgers, ice cream, anything, you know.
Did you do any research at the Dairy Queen specifically? Any Dairy Queen?
No, I didn't. I grew up in Louisiana, so in Monroe. And going to Dairy Queen was, you know, was kind of a big deal to get a chocolate dipped cone, and we'd drive around and look at houses and eat ice cream in the car. And I didn't do a lot of research, you know, just the idea to play someone who, you know, worked at it just seemed like such a small town girl that everything that Chris came up with in the outline was just so inspiring to me. I wanted to sing Melissa Manchester for my audition. I thought, like, what were some of those? What were those songs? Because I used to love, you know, as a kid and like sing, and I just pictured her just, you know, being the kind of girl that did that too. And where's the Melissa Manchester? It was funny, but he almost got the rights because they actually knew each other. And Chris is also friends with David Nickturn, who wrote Midnight at the Oasis. So to show you, but he was like, you know, we were going to shoot real soon or something. And so he's like, well, can you maybe pick an older song? And I was going through a real retro 50s thing, as you do, you know, in your 20s. I'm so into like the past, and Doris Day. So I suggested Teacher's Pet, and he liked that, and the rights were easy to get.
So I can be Teacher's Pet long after school is through. Teacher, teacher, I love you.
On Story, check your local PBS station for our television show of the same name. Every episode is a surprising and intimate look at filmmaking. Check your local listings, stream from PBS, or go to onstory.tv. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with actress Parker Posey speaking with us at a retrospective screening of Waiting for Guffman in 2016.
I guess Catherine and Fred, maybe one of them knew that Chris was friends with David, and so it was their idea to add Midnight at the Oasis and incorporate all that into, and you know, Chris wasn't like, I want to see what you're doing for the audition, you know, for Red, White, and Blaine. It was like, I showed him the monologue that I wrote, and he knew that I was going to sing I rehearsed with the piano teacher, but they didn't. It felt like a real audition, and we were all very nervous. I'm not kidding. And I'd never met Bob Balaban, and I just knew him from Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and you know, I thought he was really intimidating, and he had just arrived that day, and I remember being in that school that we shot at, and just like, I'm kind of nervous, you know? Catherine's like, yeah, we were all really nervous. It felt very real, you know?
So the improv thing, how much had you actually worked that way before you were in this?
None. I didn't like to rehearse in college, and no one wanted to work with me because I would say, like, you're killing it. Why do we want to rehearse when we're just going to, you know, it's about, with, you know, doing it live. And I went to acting school at SUNY Purchase. If there's anyone here that knows some young people that want to pursue acting, I recommend the school. And I went to North Carolina School of the Arts as a 12-year-old and went back for summer programs for acting. And there was something that kind of made me ashamed about showing something before it was the right time. So I like that kind of live thing, I guess. I wanted to be protected in my character or whatever nerdy actor thing that I was into and still am into, I guess. And so I didn't, I liked the things in acting where I would focus on the other person and forget what I was doing. And so the first day of talking as Libby May, you know, I could just rely on Chris, who is so kind and real and intelligent and a good person, you know, and empathetic. And so that was like a dream, like, oh, I get to do this. And I liked, you know, building that character and thinking about her. And he was a great, guide into that. I wasn't really thinking too much about, you know, I was young too. Like now I would be so nervous to do something like that. But then was very liberating. That said, the first night after I worked, I cried in the bathtub and I was like, what just happened? It was really interesting to see with these movies too, you know, how much pathos comes out of humor and how much, you know, kind of heart and realness. And I think if you're, you know, not a imposter and you're like an actor and it's your thing, then you are going to be somewhat funny naturally. And just to trust, you know, to trust that. But I was working with the best. And I wasn't a Spinal Tap fan because I didn't like that music. You know, I was like a new wave, you know. My brother liked Spinal Tap, but I just didn't like that music. So I wasn't like, oh, this is amazing. I was like, what's that documentary, basically? So I met Chris, and he showed me a documentary about an opera troupe. And I love documentaries. And we'll be doing this and it's going to be kind of easy and you'll just start talking and don't be afraid for space around your words or feel like you have to say anything. And
so you got thrown into this crew of people, some of who had worked together before already. And then
to me, it was like family.
Yeah.
You know, it felt so comforting to, just be, and you know, to acclimate and to be open to their, just to play and just be this character. It was really, really sweet.
Every time I see you with that lone chicken wing on the on the barbecue, it's as big a guffaw every time I see it. So where did that come from?
That was my idea. No, it wasn't. It was in the outline. Libby May cooks a chicken wing, a single chicken wing and her barbecue.
Guess I could just go back to the Dairy Queen, you know. They said they'd take me back. I always have a place at the Dairy Queen.
And I had all this backstory about my aunt that I was living with, who was into Doris Day, and Libby's dad was in prison, and I had all this stuff. And, you know, you just talk for like 7 minutes, and you're just, you know, you're rambling, and you don't know what's going to be in the movie. Yet you're, you know, you're full of just thoughts and, you know, daydreams. And, so yeah, he wrote that single, Chicken Wing. It was so good. And there was something, it's really funny, because I was there on the day that they shot it. There's a wheelchair, parked in a handicapped parking space that goes by like that, right before my last interview. Did you guys see that? Wow. Okay. And guess what? I didn't either, and I worked that day. Like, I was on set that day, and I didn't notice it, that he put a wheelchair parked in a handicapped parking space with, it's not a car, it's a wheelchair with no one in it. And see, he's like, oh, you guys don't even know. Like, he's so funny, and these people are, I feel very, I don't feel like a real improviser, you know? I feel like an actor mainly, because I didn't really have those chops. I wasn't a groundling. I wasn't a Second City person. But it's a great way to work. It's so liberating and generous. I mean, that's the thing that's so nice, that, you know, because some comedians or improvisers, you're like, let me get my line in. Everyone's just like set to like get something, you know. Yeah. It's got to be open. It's got to be, you know, generous, or it just seems like I'm going to upstage you and, you know, all that. And when I was working on Mascots a few months ago, I saw, it was a scene with Jane Lynch and Ed Begley Jr., Don Lake, Jr. and Michael Hitchcock. And I come in, something's happened. You know, I play a mascot and something's happened and I leave. And then I got to see the four of them just talking with each other and being, you know, having this, this conversation. And it was so funny. And it was like listening to music. I was like, this is like a quartet. Like, this is like, it's so generous and funny. I asked Jane Lynch, I was like, because she works a lot, you know, in comedy. And I was like, is this the best that it gets? And she's like, yeah. Yeah. Because it just, you know, like a composer, like a real maestro, he knows where to put people and how to place them together in the right tone and weight and heaviness and lightness. And but it's interesting in these movies how easily they can become really sad or dark and heavy.
You mean like the end of Guffman?
In Guffman, I think there are some deleted scenes that with Ron and Sheila that were just too sad to make it into, like, they go out to Hollywood and Chris is like, no, that's just too sad. You know, real life is like that. And I think he makes these films, they're very short. And he chooses, like, you know, just a few minutes or not even, just seconds of something. And it takes a lot of time. There was like 80 hours of footage for Waiting for Guffman that he had to whittle down to however many minutes it was. I've worked with Chris like four times now, I guess. It's like family, you know. It feels so special and warm and authentic. So you can really bring so much more of yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's really kind of scary. It really is kind of scary. And this actress named Susan Yeagley, who's in Mascots with me, we play sisters. You know, we talked a lot on the phone before we shot and stuff. And the first scene, once we like gave birth to it, we were so relieved.
When we were in high school, I got a note. Lacey passed me a note in class, yeah, in history class. And it said, I'm your sister. And I was like, yeah, I'm your sister. Yeah. I love you. Uh-huh. We go to the same church, so I thought it was
like sisters in Christ.
Yeah. And And she wrote me another note and passed it, the one on football notes. And it said, no, you're really my sister. We have the same daddy.
We do. Our chemicals are the same.
Half of them.
Half of them.
You just don't know. You don't know what's going to happen when the, you know, when the camera turns on, like what's going to be produced.
So basically you've had the opportunity with him to have a huge range of characters.
Yeah. Yes. I get to sing and dance, which I love to do. And when we were shooting Waiting for Guffman, Chris would say, you know, we could really take this to Broadway. And
how did this actually help you, or did it, when you go back to do dramatic, when you go back to doing dramatic work? I mean,
it's just such a different way of working. It can feel like artifice, uh-huh. You know, instead of just, and it's all on the people that you're acting with. You know, it's a real world where everything is contributing to, you know, what is being made. And Chris is the leader of the pack in that, and he's, you know, you want to please him. He's really, I mean, I can't believe that character he pulled out, Corky St. Clair. I mean, and he couldn't be further away from that person. Where does that come from? Where does Jennifer Coolidge? Where does that woman that she pulls out, or Fred Willard, you know? And I remember sitting in Lockhart, and he was just in an aluminum chair at night. And we had finished, and I was taking off, you know, changing out of my wardrobe. That's the other thing, you know, we dress ourselves. It's so, there's no one going like, well, I think you should wear this. You know, you really, you give a lot of, you have a lot of freedom in your character. And Fred was just sitting out on the corner, you know, and it's quiet, you know, no city lights. It was just dark. He's sitting out just facing into this small town view, smoking a cigar and just thinking, you know. And he was like turned, his back was turned away from us. And I remember just like, wow, what is he stirring up? You know, what is he thinking of, this like, this relationship that he has with this guy, this character that he creates? Like, He's like a, you know, he's a writer too. And that's the thing about these, is that the process of getting to it is so absorbing. And then you have to be in the moment and kind of let it all go, you know, be, yeah.
So you're writing somewhat your character. I mean, does that make you feel like you're really part of the writing process of the film at the, I mean, it's a different role to be playing.
Well, you write anyway when you're acting, you know, I think but the script in other films is the, you know, the skeleton and the language. So you're like, what is this line? What is the subtext of this line? What can I bring to add, you know, mystery or insight or humor to something that isn't very good, or to something that is very good? You have, you know, the material to work with. But in this, it's a lot. It's, you know, it's yours. It's a lot. So you go on set and you talk for like 7 minutes, and when we shot and film in this, you just keep talking. And what is taken from all of that is just maybe 4 seconds. I mean, some of these interviews, like David Cross and Bob Odenkirk. I mean, Bob Odenkirk had a full-on audition as that priest, as a vampire, that no one saw. And it's not. I don't think it's in the outtakes. There's such great, you know, actors who have a lot to, that are really individual, you know? And, you know, Chris gives, you know, the platform for that type of performer to let loose. It's really great.
Well, did it ever make you feel like you wanted to write after you?
Yeah, you know, I'm writing now. I'm writing something now.
A script?
No, I'm writing a how-to book. Mm-hmm. Recipes and needlepoint patterns and, you know, stories from my life as an actress, indie queen, and Just the trials and tribulations being a woman right now in the culture. And so, yeah, it's been fun.
You say this sort of sarcastically, but I mean, do you resent being the indie queen?
No. No, I'm weird. Yeah, you know, you're called something, and then it's like someone calls you a name, and so you just kind of like, you start sweating a little bit, you know? It's not like, you know, but I am kind of a queen, you know? But my mother is a queen, my grandmothers were a queen, my cousin I'm with is a queen. Drama queens.
So do you consider yourself a comedic actress?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do.
Did you intend
Would you
to
consider
be?
Me?
I do. I do. I do, but I'm not sure that you came into it that way. Did you intend?
My parents are, you know, I'm the funny, I'm the tears of a clown, Barbara. It's just tears of a clown. I've got, yeah, I need to make myself laugh on those dark, stormy days. Yeah, I'm both, you know.
Did you feel like that came out of your not liking high school?
It came from my family.
Uh-huh. Like, yeah. Is that a good thing it came from?
You know,
your family,
my grandmother, but... my dad's mom sang cowboy songs to my dad and made the family cry. You know, like, this was entertainment. And they were funny and dramatic people, you know. I'm from the South. It's like, it's full of Southern Gothic funny person. And it's time to go, because I can't talk about myself anymore like this.
Well, we're thrilled you came here to do this. Thank you so much for doing it. See?
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment of the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, and Maya Perez. Our production coordinator is Ava Mike. Editing from Brian Ramos, Jamal Knox, and Madeline Burgess. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistants, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more from the Austin Film Festival and Conference each October.
PRI, Public Radio International.